You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org. Welcome, everyone, to a very special episode of Pizza Quest. This episode was recorded on location in Atlantic City during this year's Northeast Pizza and Pasta and Bakery Expo. Over the course of 2 days, I got the chance to interview a number of luminaries in the pizza and baking world, deliver educational presentations, and talk to the judges at both the pizza and the bagel competitions. We couldn't have covered this event without the help of our underwriters, and this episode was sponsored by Central Milling. Central Milling is one of the oldest flour mills in America, providing the finest quality flour and grains to homes and bakeries across the country. To learn more about Central Milling's retail and commercial lines of flour, please visit centralmilling.com. This episode features the recording from one of my three presentations at the expo called Tinkering with Your Dough with guest panelist John Gutekunst. Enjoy. Welcome, everybody. Thank you for coming this morning. I'm Peter Reinhardt, and this is my co-panelist, John Gutekunst, and we are your Tinkering with the Dough people today. I want to, a couple quick housekeeping things. I want to mention to you that we are recording this session, but not the show is not recording it. We're recording it for a podcast. So you guys are all going to be going national when we broadcast this. Now, we're not going out live, but Liam over here is producing the session, and he'll be with me all day today and tomorrow. We're going to be creating podcasts throughout the expo and broadcasting them to folks, including interviews with a number of the pizza luminaries that are here at the show, including John. We're hoping to get him over at the podcast table, which will be downstairs on the main floor later on. But for the morning, we're going to record these information sessions, and each of them, I think, are going to be worthy enough to stand on their own as its own podcast show. So it'll be going out over my podcast is called Pizza Quest with Peter Reinhardt. It's produced by the Heritage Radio Network. HRN is now, they've shortened it to HRN. Liam is one of the producers and engineers for them. Coincidentally, coincides with the book. And if any of you are interested, I've brought some books. If anyone wants to get signed copies, we can do that later. And Pizza Quest is a collection of pizza concepts developed by some of the top pizza makers in mainly North America, but there's a few internationals in there. And then I created home versions, small batch versions. I call them tribute pizzas. So like John has a wonderful recipe in there. It's a schiacciata, I think. Is it a pear? Blue cheese pear?
Schiacciata. Way in the back of the book.
Yeah. And but the point is that these were things that, could be complicated, but what my job was to simplify them. So I say that these guys are like the Beatles, and I'm like the Beatles tribute band that plays in the Marriott Hotel, and plays their greatest hits. So we create greatest hits versions of some of these, like 35 wonderful pizza ideas. So that's what this book's about. And John, being one of the luminaries, I use as a term because I don't know what else other than pizza geniuses, pizza experts. So let me just very briefly give you a quick background. For some of you know John already, but let me just tell you a few highlights from his extensive bio here. It's a full career of things, but this is what his bio says.
Gypsy life.
Yeah, and for those who are listening who don't know John, John is an intense pizza obsessive, an author, a teacher, a blogger, a small businessman who thrives in culinary situations where innovation and originality are crucial. And that's how we connected over. I mean, we did an interview with John on Pizza Quest, and it's just his creativity is just brimming over, and I love it. I'm going to skip through this, but in April of 2000, the year 2000, after a full year as a culinary chef and prior career in cryptology and all sorts of other things that he's done in the past, he went all in on the pizza life and opened the high-volume Avalanche Pizza and Bakery in Athens, Ohio, which today creates over 120,000 pizzas a year. For 22 years, it has been voted the title Best Pizza in Athens and has been featured on the Food Network and in Food Arts, Edible Columbus, Restaurants and Institutions, National Geographic, Columbia Dispatch, and Pizza Today. John is also a regular contributor, columnist in Pizza Today magazine. Some of you may know him from there. In continuing his own search for the perfect pizza, he graduated from the oldest pizza university in Italy,
the Scuola Italiano Pizzaioli. He's a monthly contributing editor and writer to Pizza Today magazine, and has also published stories in Gastronomica, Alimentum food journals, and his proudest achievement was to be selected in there's an annual anthology called Best Food Writing. So in the Best Food Writing of 2012, he had an article published. One of his articles was republished in that collection of Best Food Writing of that year. What was that article about?
It was about finding truffles, going for competition in Italy, and we thought we could just go to the grocery store and get truffles, and it turned into this mafia escapade in the mountains of Emilia Romagna. So it was kind of fun.
Truffles, huh? So was that was published in what, in Gastronomica?
Yes.
So Gastronomica, I don't know if any of you know, Gastronomica I don't think it exists anymore. I'm not sure if it does. Fabulous, culinary sociology. And quarterly magazine of high quality writing. It was a big honor for anyone to get published in that. And its readership was relatively small because it wasn't Popular Mechanics. It was for people who were serious geeks about food. Yeah. And so that was a pretty cool thing. Mm-hmm. Even with all these major commitments, John still finds time to travel, hike, and forage for pizza ingredients. And that's one of the part of the creativity is he's all constantly doing very innovative things both at Avalanche and in your articles. So, and he's got a whole bunch of awards and everything else. So that was sort of very brief intro just so we can get the ball rolling. So a little bit about his background. I'm a culinary instructor and baking instructor at Johnson & Wales University. I've been there for the last 25 years. And prior to that, California Culinary Academy. And before that, I had my own bakery in California, in Santa Rosa, California. And kind of came into pizza through the bread world, as many people have done today. A lot of bakers have moved into pizza. A lot of pizza makers have moved into baking, and there's a lot of crossover. So we'll be talking about that a little bit in my next session. For those of you who feel like coming over for that, it'll be across the hall on the bread part of the expo. There's a combination of expos going on here: pizza, pasta, and artisan baking. I'll be talking about things that. New developments in what I call the future of bread, where I think bread is going, which really these days you could say bread and pizza and almost interchange them because there's so much overlap. So that's, there's always something new and interesting to talk about. And so with that said, today's session, we are recording it and there's no mic on the floor, but it's really dependent on all of you to help us out by asking questions. Hopefully you're here because you're interested in tweaking your own dough. This is called tweaking your dough. We've done this presentation for a number of years and usually hear something every year. There's always a question that can stump us. So we'll do our best to share our knowledge with you. John, did you want to make any introductory comments before we get going?
Yeah, I'm honored to be here with Peter Wright. When he asked me to be on a panel, I'm like, oh yeah, I'll be on a panel. I'm thinking I'm the guy down at the end. And then he said, so it'll be you and me.
We're the panel.
I told my wife, she's like, are you crazy? Better get your big BS thing out, John. So any percentages or anything like that goes to Peter today, okay? But I'm very, very happy.
Thank you.
Started my pizzeria after reading American Pie.
Really?
I
didn't know that.
Loved that book. Chris Bianco was introduced to me and with American Pie. So
that's
it's my hero.
So yeah, that book came out almost 20 years ago. And again, it was an extension of my bread work. I was like, I'd said pretty much everything I could think of about the science of bread making and the craft of bread making. And I said, well, what left do I have to say? And what else do I love to write about and eat? And bread and pizza, really. I said, there's not much of a leap. But at that time, back in like 2002 or 3 when I was starting on that book, there wasn't much overlap. The pizza expos were happening, but it wasn't. Mm-hmm. It was a much smaller event. Some of you have probably been to the Vegas show, and it's huge now, right? There's like 10,000 people a day show up there, but it was still a small community then, and there was an artisan bread movement happening that had kind of was running a parallel track. Somebody who I got to know in the artisan bread side of my life was Brian Spangler, who we were just interacting with on the phone. He sometimes sits on this panel, and he's a regular contributor to the Pizza Quest podcast. And Brian's got a pizzeria out in Portland, Oregon, but he was an artisan bread baker then, had a small little bakery on the side of a mountain, and and he decided to like move into the pizza sector. And that was a kind of a sign, a harbinger of what was to come, because then all of a sudden we started to see this, the overlap of the knowledge that the bread bakers community, the bread bakers Guild of America had brought a lot of new knowledge to the American bakers that had to do with baking science, things that the European breadmasters knew that we didn't. And then suddenly that knowledge started to leap over into the pizza community, and pizza makers were going, how can I take my pizza to the next level? Yep. And we always say, as a bread baker, I always say, you start with the dough. The key is always with the crust. And so, and I'm guessing that's why a lot of you are here today. Yep. So if we start to say things that aren't clear concepts that might be familiar now to the bread baking community, because we've been, you know, throwing them around for so many years, but if you're not familiar with them, don't hesitate to ask us to explain it in more depth. Some of the people who are listening to this, because this will, once we air it, which will probably go out in the next couple of weeks, it'll live forever, you know, so we don't want to leave anyone who's listening behind also. All right. And with that said, what I will do, since there's no mic on the floor, I will try to repeat your question so that the radio audience can hear it as well. All right. So if anybody would like to get the ball rolling, we will do our best to toss us up a couple softballs and we'll see if we can hit them out of the park. Anybody want to give it? Yeah, there's a question in the back. And say it loud. Uh-huh. Okay, so it's a two-part question. One was, in Italy, since they don't have a lot of refrigeration and, you know, there's not a lot of space in the operations, how do they do long, slow fermentation, or do they do faster fermentation? How do they handle their fermentation issues? And then the question was, if you need a dough today, is there a way to make a good dough in a short amount of time? Is that pretty much a summary of what your question is? All right, John. How do you deal with that challenge?
A lot of the Italian pizzaioli, they will use less yeast and do a longer ferment in just air. So instead of a teaspoon for every pound, they would go half a teaspoon, even a quarter teaspoon if they really know that their climate. You know, depending if you're in Naples or if you're in Emilia Romagna, it all depends. But that long ferment is what they're looking for, especially with the 00 flour.
Yeah, and I think that flour also is not designed. I mean, if people are doing long fermentations with the Italian style flours, but it's not necessarily designed for that, mm-hmm. Because they're not looking for the same types of caramelization that American pizza lovers, you know, kind of reach for.
Yeah, I was disappointed sometimes. As an American and being in French, you know, bakeries a lot, I was like, wow, look at the crust on these. There's no caramelization on this in the bakeries. And but the bread tasted wonderful.
Well, the flour, it's so sweet. And you usually, again, so many factors are at play in fermentation. But the key to any good bread product, at least a leavened bread product, is the fermentation is the magic, you know, that transforms it from just a piece of clay into something that has depth and complexity. And I'll put this both as a part answer and also a question back to the audience. You know, we're finding that lots of small pizza makers, whether it's in Italy or any other parts of the world, many are moving into the natural fermentation or leaven, you know, naturally leavened category. So there are pizza makers over there that are not using commercial yeast, using starch, just like more and more pizzerias in the United States now are doing naturally fermented, we'll call it, for lack of a better term, sourdough style pizzas, or combinations of the two. How many of you in the audience, and in the audience right now we have about 50 or so people today, how many of you use natural leavening and fermentation in your operations? And for those who are listening, the most of the people here are, for the most part, professional in the business, in the pizza business. Is that a true statement? Are most of you in the pizza business? Yes, I'm getting nods. Yeah. Okay, so are any of you doing natural fermentation, or are most of you using commercial yeast? How about, raise your hand if anyone's doing natural fermentation. So Just a couple. Oh, just a couple of you. So this we're going to see. If I ask the same question next year, I have a feeling we're going to see 2 to 3 or 4 times more hands go up, because still the standard right now in America is commercial yeast. And as part of John's answer, you can control the amount of yeast you put in and slow fermentation down. You can still get a leavened product with half the amount of yeast than we're used to using. Which goes back to part two of your question, is how do you get a dough that can be ready to use in a shorter amount of time? And what are the trade-offs? Well, how do you do your fermentation, John?
Many different ways. I'm really getting into the Roman style, which is a long, it's a direct method like you guys are all used to with yeast, and then just a long fermentation time. And you get that beautiful airy crust, especially in the long pizzas.
By long, how long do you mean?
About 3 feet, pizza al
natro. I mean, how long the time?
Oh, 72 hours, 60 to 72 hours sometimes, so cold.
So 3 to
no, in to cold temperatures. And I've been using Peter's Pan Longchamp recipe for my baguettes, which is, it's beautiful. It's just beautiful. It's direct method, just with yeast. But the key is using ice cold water, ice cold water. I put it in the freezer before I even mix it. And then I run them, Chris knows, my managing partner back there, I'll run them to the back and create 40 to 60 baguettes on weekends. And it coaxes the sugars out of the starch. And it has such a better flavor and such a better crust. And it's just magical at about 450 degrees.
So. As far as the question having to do with same day, and we'll come back. I see that there's some comments on this, so we won't leave the subject yet. But so how to make it happen faster. So a couple ground rules for baking is, and they're fundamentals. I wouldn't say that they're laws. They're more like guidances, is that longer, slower fermentation will bring out more flavor in the dough as long as you don't over-ferment your dough. And the way you can control the three things that are the critical factors are time, temperature, and the ingredients themselves. So certain flour lends itself to shorter fermentations. It doesn't need as much to bring out the flavor. The ultimate goal, I knew the one thing I forgot to do is bring up a bottle of water. The ultimate goal is to coax the most flavor out of your ingredients, out of your flour and your grain. And you do that through a combination of time and temperature. And you can manipulate the length of time and temperature. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
I appreciate it. I'm going to take a swallow of water. You can manipulate time by controlling temperature.
Yep.
So for every 17 degrees Fahrenheit that you raise the fermentation, zone, you can double the rate of fermentation. The yeast is very sensitive to that. So a dough that would typically take, let's say, 2 hours to double in size at room temperature, we'll say in a little proof box, let's say 80 degrees. If it takes 2 hours at 80 degrees, if you reduce that temperature by 17 degrees, meaning bringing it down to, 63 degrees, it would take 4 hours. It would take twice as long. If you want to increase the speed of fermentation, you raise the temperature, go up 17, and you don't have to always use 17, but every time you raise the temperature, it increases the rate of fermentation. Will that increase give you the same quality of flavor? Not necessarily, because it's not just the yeast that's creating flavor in your dough. There's bacterial fermentation, which is also affected by temperature, and that creates more acidity and complexity that way. There's enzyme activity. And so, again, going back to the Italian flours, why do we not see as much caramel, golden caramel colors in that flour? Because it doesn't have as many enzymes. It doesn't have the malted barley flour that most American flours have that add enzymatic activity that breaks starches apart and release the natural sugars that are in those starches that will then caramelize when they get to 325 degrees in the oven. So all these things, there's like all this interaction and drama that's taking place that allows for almost a, what would you say, I wouldn't say infinite, but multitude number of variations in the possibility. And so you change your flour, it could change all the other parts of the factory. You change your temperature, it changes everything else. But the one thing we can control the most is time and temperature. Yep. And then after that is finding the flour that gives you the results that you want.
Yeah, we call it emergency dough. When you run out of dough, you're so busy, and I think a lot of you guys have gone through that. Oh my gosh, what are we going to do? One thing that helps in a pizzeria like that is a proofing cabinet, okay? You can control those temperatures like that as long as you don't go too high, and be ready for pizzas in an hour or so or whatever.
And going back to the enzyme activity, so if you feel like, okay, that the enzymes need about 7 to 12 hours to at least do most of their work to create, to release some of those natural sugars. So if you want to speed that up because you have to in that circumstance, you could boost the enzymes by putting in a small amount of diastatic malt powder. Diastatic meaning that the diastase enzymes are still active, as opposed to non-diastatic malt, which is what they use in bagels, which gives you a lot of malty flavor but no enzyme activity. Whereas diastatic, and all that stuff,
it's
goopy
malt, right?
Yeah, it's like syrup. It's like molassesy. And but all those are available, let's say, at beer making, you know, supply stores and things like that, or some of your suppliers have those ingredients. Some companies like Central Milling, for instance, can sell you malt, or other, you know, bakery supply companies that can sell diastatic and non-diastatic malt. But it doesn't take much. Like a half a percentage of the weight of your flour would be like a big healthy vitamin pill shot of malted enzyme activity. And the malt's coming from barley mainly because it's high in these enzymes. But there's plenty of other ways to get malted. If you sprout any kind of flour, even wheat, it increases the enzyme activity. So it's all these different tricks that bakers have learned over the years to, again, deal with the question of, okay, I don't have as much time as I usually have. I can't do what John's doing and ferment my dough slowly at cold temperatures and stretch and fold it over a couple of days to keep it going. I need it sooner. Then there are a couple little tweaks that you could make. And one of those options is a small shot of malt, of active malt. We call it diastatic. So I knew you had a comment. So the question is, after he mixes the dough, does he form it into a dough ball, or do you just mix it and let it bulk ferment? Is that the question?
I have another question.
Okay, well, let's get.
If you do bulk ferment it, how long do you let it stay on the, you know, like at room temperature before you put it in the fridge?
So how long is the bulk fermentation?
We do both at my place. We ball up immediately for some pizzas, for some long proofing stuff. I usually, especially bread type pizzas things. And we do get a lot of, that's not bread, or that's not pizza, like he was talking about before, now, because we're integrating toppings into breads. But I do both, in 45 minutes, usually. 45 minutes is enough in my place, yeah. A big bin is really good. A big plastic bin works well. I put it aside, because we have zero room. We have 1,000 square feet. And
yeah. So if you're going to bulk ferment, how big of a piece do you put in?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's why you'll find me on my knees in my cooler. Literally on the bottom of your cooler is the coldest place. Okay. It's the concrete underneath there that's really, really cold. So I usually set it on that. Okay. And I will go in there every 10 minutes and fold it. Just in the bin.
And the stretch and folding partly helps to develop the strength, but it also equalizes the temperature. And so these are, again, depending on your circumstances, you have not a lot of space, you've got to get pretty creative. If you have big facilities and lots of refrigeration, but remember, the bigger the piece of dough going in the refrigerator, the longer it's going to take to cool down. And until the dough gets down to 40 degrees or below, there's going to be a lot of yeast activity. It's going to slow down as it gets cooler. So there are some situations where if you put a big piece of dough into a cooler, it could be a very cold box, but by the time that the whole dough cools down, it may have over-fermented by that point, which is another reason why a lot of people will ball their piece of doughs up early in the game, because they want the dough to cool down faster, because they're going to be holding it for a couple of days and they don't want it to ferment. They'd like it to ferment very, very slowly.
And on that note, usually if I have these big blobs, we use trays instead of dough boxes. Dough boxes hold in so much more heat. We'll take trays, oil the top, put Saran wrap on them, pop them, and we use a technical term called the blob. The blob.
Very technical.
Put a blob on it. It's you go half the size, you put it right down the middle of a sheet pan, a large sheet pan, because it will expand a little bit before it starts calming down in the pool.
How many of you tend to do long fermentations before you start use the dough? Only about 20% of the hands have gone up. Yeah. And so the rest of you are doing making dough on the same day and using it that day, or are you using it doing overnight? Most of you are overnighting, but you're overnighting the dough balls or the bulk dough? Dough balls, yeah. Because you have more control. It's all about control. Bakers and pastry chefs, we're control freaks. And that's how you become good at anything, is you have to know what you can control and what you can't control. And pastry chefs are way worse than bakers when it comes to being obsessive, control freaks. But bakers are still, partially obsessive control freaks too, because you have to. Because
that's why they're so mean.
Yeah. Okay, more questions. Yes.
Going back to the naturally leavened dough, are you seeing that trend primarily in Neapolitan style, not so much Roman style or anything of that nature?
It's changing. It's growing more. I think here's one of the trends. I'll be talking about this in the future of bread presentation, is that natural or sourdough style fermentation, we'll use sourdough as a shorthand term for it, that trend is getting bigger and bigger exponentially every year. More and more people are moving into it. It's kind of like the final frontier of control freak baking, because it's your biggest challenge. It's like walking a tightrope without a safety net underneath. And so people love it, but also the results, when properly managed, can yield flavors that you can't get with commercial yeast. It can be any kind of flour. And again, certain flours respond differently or better to that style of fermentation. But I mean, natural leavened baking has been around much longer than commercially yeasted baking. That commercial yeast is 150 years old, maybe, and it is a convenience for us to allow us to make a lot more product in a lot shorter amount of time. And the trade-offs are, number one, one of the reasons why sourdough is growing as a category is that the longer fermentation that it requires in order to get the maximum flavor also allows for the dough to become more digestible. It helps almost pre-digest the dough for you because of the acidity and the enzyme activity. All that stuff starts to break it down so that it's a lot easier. And there are people, it's anecdotal, but who will say, I can't eat yeasted products, but I can eat sourdough products. Why? I don't know why. And it's because for those particular people, their sensitivity, let's say, to gluten or to the other issues in flour that may be not the gluten but something else, are mitigated by the longer fermentation.
That's the biggest questions you'll get in Italy if you're competing in Italy, is how long has your dough been fermenting? And it's because it's all about digestibility over there. You can have a big pizza over there and you don't feel that. You ever go out and have a pizza and you're like, oh God, that cheese is on my belly. No, that's not the cheese, it's the dough. It's just sitting on your belly.
How many times have you heard someone say, I can't eat bread in America, but when I go to Italy, I can eat the bread. Yeah. Why is that? I hear it all the time. And you don't know how much of it is real and how much of it is psychological, but I think there's a lot of reality to it as well. And again, longer, slower fermentation. Yeah.
I work for a flour company, and what I've been finding out is I've been visiting some of the old schoolers that had like a 96-hour fermentation, but now they're second generation, third generation are coming in. Number one, skill level has been a big issue.
Yeah.
And secondly, the patients, they want to...
Faster.
What's a good way or at least good some reference material to help them? Because some of them want to knock it down in half. But it also, for that long fermentation gives you wonderful characteristics.
Yes.
How can you avoid that, or where can you maybe go back and reference some material to help bring that down? You can still get the same characteristics, the same flavors, the same...
So the question is, how can you actually get those same properties but in a less amount of time?
Right.
Because time is money too, and
I found that I read one of his books and he talks, and it's so funny. I'm like, oh, I do the same thing. For natural fermentation, I throw a little kick. I call it a kicker. okay? A little bit of yeast in. When I know I'm not going to have as much time, I put a little kicker. I'll put old dough in. And I learned that in France. So a lot of the baguette guys, and we busted in on a lot of bakeries in Paris when we were there. And they all had old dough, just big, ugly blob of old dough that they'll soaker, like you call it a soaker, soak it with some warm water and pop it in the mix.
Yeah, because it's already been pre-fermented, so it's putting a lot of flavor in. But so there are some tricks for that, using starters, using sponges. All those are all ways of manipulating time and temperature, and mostly time. Mm-hmm. So the question is, how can I get if my father's dough takes 96 hours, but I don't want to wait 96 hours, and we're losing money in that 96 hours. You know, how can I make more profit without losing quality? And can it be done? And, you know, we did have a workshop here a couple of years ago where I think the question was, the topic of the thing was, is 24 hours enough? Is 36 hours too long? You know, it's like, where are the parameters? And back then, there weren't that many people doing 96-hour or 120-hour fermentations. We started to see that. Massimiliano Saiva, the Roman Pizza Academy, was doing like, you know, a 5-day fermentation. Other people started to use it, and they started to feel that their regular, you know, American Neapolitan style pizzas were responding well to that long fermentation. But then there are other people saying, you know, I only wait between 24 and 36 hours, and that's all I need to get the maximum flavor that I'm looking for. And so there is no one rule that governs that. There's experimentation. There's sometimes we become so locked into a method that we've come that worked that is not necessarily working for a logical reason, but psychologically or emotionally we feel connected to that method. So we don't want anyone to tamper with it or mess with it when somebody else can say, but I can prove to you that I can get the same properties in 36 hours that you're getting in 96 hours, and you don't want to hear it. What is the term for that? Confirmation bias. It's called confirmation bias. If you're convinced, it doesn't matter, you know, what they hear. But then on the other hand, because I'm not convinced that it takes 96 to 100 hours to, you know, or 120 hours to get the quality of pizza that Massimiliano gets from his pizza. But I'm not going to fight the fact that his pizzas are phenomenal. Some of you may have had them here in the past. I don't think he's here this year. He's moved back to Barcelona or somewhere. But his pizzas were fabulous. But he also changed flours. At that time, he was representing a flour company. I'm not sure which one. I don't know if it's yours or yours. It was an Italian flour company. And he said, this is the flour that we use to make my pizzas. And then later on, he switched to, I think he may be working with Caputo now. I'm not sure. He wasn't Caputo then. And he's probably modified his recipe to conform to the way that Caputo flour, you know, responds to his technique.
The flour is, they inherited these recipes. So they haven't worked them, and
I call it the garbage can dough, where they put it in a garbage can, put it under the oven, and then just chop off pieces. Don't weigh it at all, and just comes out like.
Does it work?
It works for a lot of places.
If it works, you're not going to want to, you know. And sometimes you don't want to hear that there's a better way to do it, because if it's working, it's not broke. You know, why fix it? And I'm afraid if I take your advice, I'm going to lose quality, or I'm going to lose my emotional connection. It's a real thing. Our emotional connection to our techniques and our recipes, and the way our forebears taught us how to do it. Our grandma taught me how to do it this way. I'm not going to mess with her sacred recipe. You know, those are real emotional things. And again, if it's working, the bottom line is it working? You know, are you happy with it? And if you are happy, you don't have to change it just because somebody else says you don't need to do it that way. But if you want to know the science side of it and why, what the rationale for making those changes are, that knowledge is now available in a way that it wasn't available 20 and 30 and 40 years ago. And so you can apply it. And a lot of new people who are coming into the game are coming into the game, but through that kind of training. You went to a school, the Scuolo in Italy, to learn. And whatever their technique is, you know, God help you if you mess with their technique. Ooh, man. They're going to teach you a certain way to do it. Yep. And if you want to be certified by them, you got to follow that technique, even though somebody else could prove to them that there's another way to get there, right?
Yep. I was scored the lowest. They said, you are the lowest score of any any best here.
Even
man.
The lowest.
Like, well, you guys took me out every night, man. What am I going to do?
But they gave you the certification anyway.
Yes. Stamp of approval.
Well, I'm glad they were at least tolerant of your of your inability to follow their precise directions. That's a question in the back.
So we're actually from your neck of the woods, Peter. We're from North Carolina.
I love it.
If you, so, let's just say North Carolina goes up to 90% humidity.
Yeah.
It does.
Yeah.
How do you alter that?
So he's asking about how do we balance out the humidity if you live in a place like North Carolina where it can be very humid, and many places are very humid. What about if you're in Florida, you know, humidity is a way of life. How do you factor that in to your fermentation? I'll go first, and then if you want to throw you some comments. So, as a baker, I always felt like humidity was my friend, right? We want humidity because also barometric pressure and other things that are like, you know, that go along with that, because humidity helps to keep the dough moist and more pliable and flexible. It's not necessarily going to make it fast. The humidity is not what makes it rise faster. The temperature does, but humidity always seems to go hand in hand with temperature, and barometric pressure can sometimes exert, you know, like a resistance against rising. So sometimes a dough will develop flavor without necessarily rising a lot because it hasn't developed a lot of carbon dioxide, but it has developed a lot of sugar breakout through enzyme activity. So it's all sorts of things that can be a factor. As far as controlling, you know, a dough that you're fermenting in North Carolina based on both temperature, ambient temperature, and humidity in the air might be different than you would ferment that dough if you were in, you know, Ohio or someplace where you also have humidity, but, you know, you have cooler winters and, you know, maybe not as hot of the summer. I don't, you know, all those are, and from day to day, you're also having to factor, no matter where you live, if you're fermenting, you know, not in a controlled proof box, but at ambient temperatures, you know, on a speed rack or something like that, you're always having to adjust to that. On a warm day, your dough's going to rise faster. So again, there's no one rule to answer your question. How do you control it? A lot of it is trial and error and becoming sensitive. The dough is going to teach you. That's the other kind of thing that we say to our students is, you know, let the dough tell you what it needs and keep a record, keep a notebook, you know, and chart it. And you can typically, after a few months, you could probably get a sort of an instructional guide for your team to say, listen, when the temperature goes above this, we're finding that we need, you know, less fermentation time, and the dough's going to go faster. In fact, we can lose it if we wait too long. The dough can start to develop sort of the taste of dead yeast or of too much alcohol or whatever. So you've got to chart that stuff. There are probably in some baking science books charts that, you know, will say for every so many degrees, like I was saying before, 17 degrees, there's ways to chart that. But when temperatures are fluctuating and you don't have control devices like proof boxes that give you the same humidity day by day, but if you do have a proof box, you usually set the humidity for somewhere between 65 to 75% humidity. That's the ideal. You want it to be kind of moist in there. John,
yeah, that's the proofing cabinets are just, they're glorious. But I've felt that sometimes, just doing dough in the middle of summer, abusive heat and humidity, and before I can get even through the batch, I'm racing to get the stuff into the walk-in, or not putting it in dough boxes, or just putting plastic over it, and because I know I've got 2 days before I'm going to use it. So that's a tough. You just have to watch your blood pressure
going. With your dose, your long fermentation dose, that you're doing all that at ambient temperature. You're not putting it in refrigeration or
no,
chillers.
No, I do put it in. It's all goes in
refrigeration. Oh, you use refrigeration, yeah. Because remember, you know, 100 years ago, nobody had refrigeration. Maybe, I don't know, but maybe it's 120 years ago, but whenever refrigeration came along, that was a technology change that was a game changer.
Yeah.
And it opened up possibilities. But people that learned how to make bread or pizza without refrigeration didn't necessarily feel like they needed it because they had a system that worked. But refrigeration was a game changer. The cold, long, slow, cold fermentation wasn't possible, you know, before that came into existence. So a lot of these techniques that were developed in both the bread and pizza side are more recent innovations. And people were, by testing the limits and by just saying, what if I tried this, then would it make a difference? And sometimes it works, but you're not sure why it works. So then you try to find, you know, the science behind it that explains why it worked so that you can, again, control it better. I hope that wasn't a very precise answer to your question about how do we respond to it, but it, some of it is that it's the answer sometimes is it depends. It depends on your circumstances. But like you were saying, sometimes just putting plastic, right? You put it right on the dough?
Right on the dough. Yeah.
And how do you keep the plastic? So you oil the dough so that you can peel it off, but by putting it right on the dough as opposed to covering a bin with some airspace in between, you're reducing the amount of airflow that's affecting that dough. But I think it's things like that where you're in a situation where there's fluctuation a lot, you have to keep track rather than say, okay, you just get a feel for it. And you can train some people to have a feel for it, but you can't train everybody. Yeah. Some people need very precise instructions. So it'd be great to say, okay, this is what we've learned. This is what our dough has taught us, that on days that are around this temperature or this humidity, this is the kind of response we get. And we'll use that as a guideline. And then let those be guidelines, not necessarily rules and laws, but then it comes down to training your staff. And frankly, people can't get a feeling for anything unless they've done it a lot. They just don't have it. They develop through practice. Okay, more questions. Yes.
So we've had a lot of questions about traditional dough. What about those that are a little bit more experimental or designer, like trying to create a dough specifically for a dessert kind of application,
mm-hmm.
or something that's like an international fusion?
Yeah.
What kind of ingredients have you added that don't compromise the integrity of the dough itself?
So anything.
And the question was, how can you, for those who couldn't hear the question, how can you create unique and specific doughs with other ingredients than just the basic flour, water, salt, and yeast? And how do you develop that? And John, you've done a lot of that.
Yeah, we do a lot of French fougas. And I basically, it's like a giant, what we used to call in hotels is a giant chef's basket. It's a precursor to Chopped, where I'll get all this stuff and have to really fast manipulate it in some way to incorporate it into dough. So we do a direct method dough, and we'll knead it into the, be it olives, rosemary, and roasted garlic, or carrots and cherries and pistachio nuts, and we do that. And you get some wows out of it. You can also mix flours. I love working with semolina and brioche. Brioche is a controlled dough that you could either have savory or sweet, and you can add white chocolate to it and stuff. But and semolina, this fine semolina that you get, is like a cake-like texture.
Yeah.
And I love topping that as a focaccia, maybe with like in a focaccia barese, which is has a little bit of mashed potatoes in it. And if you cook the tomatoes at 160 for 3 hours or something, they go on the focaccia and you don't get that gum line underneath the tomatoes. Mm. It's just spectacular. So, stuff like that.
If I could summarize a little bit of what he was just saying, categorize it, let's say, is that one of the things that in culinary schools that we teach our students is that you have to understand the functionality of your ingredients. That if you can learn what the ingredients' various functions are, then you can deploy those functions, you know, in a product when you're creating something new and original. So, you know, sugar has a totally different function than flour, but flour is consistent of a certain amount of sugar, natural sugar that's in there, but it has more starch. But what is starch? Starch is ultimately sugar if you break the starch apart into its components. So, and then what does fat do? And what's the function of fat? And if the function of fat is number one, you know, to enrich a dough, to make it more tender, to hold in more moisture, it has different functions that more than just one. But once you know what those functions are, then are you limited as to what fat you can use? What if, you know, in the pizza crust, we have one dough that was made with bacon fat, others that were made with chicken schmaltz. You know, those are all fats. For a long time, lard was the fat of choice in American baking because it was it was available, certainly down in the South, and it was very, and it's very functional. It's 100% fat. It's not like butter or margarine, which is only 80% fat. So all these functions, you know, help you to determine what you can and can't do. Brioche is mainly defined by the use of butter as its fat, as opposed to oil. But oil and butter can do the same functions, and there's a lot of those that actually perform better with liquid oil, which is 100% fat. For instance, babka. I found that my chocolate babka dough, which is wonderful enriched dessert type bread, works better with oil than it does with butter, and I don't miss the butter in that dough. Sometimes we use a combination of both, but I don't miss it because there's so many other sweet and rich ingredients in the dough that I'd rather have the functionality of the vegetable oil. So again, when you're being creative and trying to create things, understanding what the purpose of those ingredients to go in there are for the dough and what they contribute to the product itself, not just the dough, but the whole product, will give you more, it will empower you. And again, we talk about control, and really, what is control? It's power, you know, and that's what we all want, is to be empowered to create the best possible products. Does that help?
Okay. Powders help too. I mean, you could do powdered curry with onions and incorporate that into a bread. We do a curry fugazi, very popular, especially with maple syrup and pizzas, blue pea flour powder. It makes it blue. A little shocking. You can use charcoal, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
He's cringing now.
No, I'm not. Because you can. That's the point, is once you understand what the ingredients can do, you can do almost anything with them. You deploy them. And that's when it starts to get really fun to be a creative cook. Yeah. But let me ask this question. How many of you, show of hands, how many of you in your operations have something comparable to a Hawaiian pizza? Your pineapple with pineapple. About 10%, 15% of the room raised their hand. How many of you have gotten into arguments and debates with people over, you know, is it a sin to put pineapple on? Is that not, you know, is that wrong? Is that a bad thing to do? Some of you raised your hand because that's a big, that's kind of one of those what would you call it, an inflection point in the pizza world. But yet, the guy who developed the Hawaiian pizza was not from Hawaii, right? The story of the Hawaiian pizza is that it was invented by a guy in Canada, who had a background in Asian cooking, and in Asian cooking, the juxtaposition of fruit and savory, sweet and savory, and things like that was part of the palate of the food. And he said, "I'd like to try that." You know, again, it's how you define pizza. If you define pizza in the strict Neapolitan form, that pizza is, it's flour, water, salt, yeast, and it's Italian ingredients, it's tomatoes, and what's his name? Lucali says it's got to punch you in the face. You know, with this, with this particular, this is very defined. Yeah. Or is pizza just dough with something on it? Which Scott Wiener, who's in the next room talking right now, will say, you know, you could almost, a lot of things could be called pizza if it's dough with something on it, if that's the range that we're doing. So, and Wolfgang Puck proved this 40 years ago at Spago when he started putting international style pizzas on the menu, which later became the California Pizza Kitchen, where they said, look, if pizza's just dough with something on it, why not make it international? And in fact, by the way, doesn't every culture in the world have some variation of pizza of its own that they may not call pizza, but when you look at it in those terms, is like pizza. So a lot of it is how we determine it, and the bottom line is, how does it taste? Because the one who wins is the one who delivers the most flavor to their customers, a flavor that their customers love. So you, that argument, I love the Hawaiian pizza argument, because it can be, you can respond to it depending on your perspective. And back to functionality of ingredients. There's a true culinary principle at work when you have the contrast of sweet and savory working together, and so you may not use pineapple to create that, but John, you have the one in the book that's it's got pears, mm-hmm. and it's got blue cheese, mm-hmm. and a few other ingredients and some herbs and things like that and spices, and that's what you're doing basically. You're playing with the contrast and the impact of that contrast on your palate.
And it all depends on the market you're in, okay? People are, they're educated now. There's cooking shows out. People just immerse themselves in these cooking shows. They're becoming experts. And a lot of people, there, you know, I get guys from the hills going, I want some of that that Chinese cabbage on my, that spicy Chinese. I'm like, you mean kimchi? Yeah, sure, we have that. And, you know, put it on there. Put some mandarin oranges on there, too. You know, and people are expanding their palates. And that's on all of you, you know, in business. You want to stay on that curve. Of you know, if you're getting your and this is my thought, if you're getting your stuff from new trends from the New York Times or Eater, you're probably 5 years behind. Okay, so we at Avalanche, we're like, wow, we did that 7 years ago. We're on to new things now, so it's pretty fun.
But you can go broke being a visionary.
You can, yeah, totally. I know,
but we all love to, you know, celebrate the ones who were like, who saw it coming before the wave hit. But by the time it hits, you know, they may be out of business.
They always say the first million's the hardest. So
and sometimes they say it's better to be second than to be first with an idea. The one who came in second, who came on at second, made more money at it. You know, so I do product development, and some of you probably do, you know, some consulting for other companies, and I do product development for a company that makes frozen versions of, you know, entrees, vegetarian entrees. And I'll come to them sometimes with an idea, and I say, this is like a wave that's about to hit the shore, and I think you guys should, you know, be out there with it first. And they go, no, we'll wait till one of the bigger guys does a version of it, and then we'll just do a better version of it. Because we'll let them create the market for this thing. And that's their actual business strategy, is to be second, but to do it better.
Second mouse always gets the cheese.
There you go. I hadn't heard that one. That's good. Yeah. A question over there.
Do you make a New York style pie at the pizzeria? Is it direct vetted with commercial yeast?
New York style pie, did you say?
New York style pie. Direct vetted. We use it 48 to 72 hours later. So, but I would like to switch over possibly to a natural fermentation.
The natural, huh?
But we have a lot of staff members that make the dough at the different shops. So I've always been like hesitant because I'm afraid of a starter or a foolish, like it seems very. What should I do?
Yeah, if you're going to innovate your doughs,
knowing that there's multiple hands in it.
Right? If you're going to innovate your doughs, there's a risk factor there because not everybody gets it. That's a good question.
How many are you selling? A lot.
We've been in 15 years in April.
Wow. Okay.
And mainly, you've been making it the convention, we'll call it conventional way, using yeast and as your fermentation
yeast,
leavening.
Wow.
Yeah.
And ferment on the table, bag over about 30-45 minutes, then we boil it up, put it in the fridge.
Yeah, and now you'd like to see if you can tweak it and push it and get some new flavor profiles.
That, you know, to make it feel like we put sugar in the dough in the first 5-6 years, took that away.
Took sugar out.
Uh-huh. Now, like, so I want to feel that lightness before you give me, like, a whole pot and not feel that.
Yeah.
So that's where, you know, so he's asking how can people feel less digestive issues, feel that after they've eaten it, they haven't had a gut bomb, and how much of that can be a factor of the dough, the fermentation of the dough. And then second part is, how do you train your staff to follow those procedures? Yeah, so there's terms like biga, pulis. These are pre-ferments. These are pre-fermented doughs that are added to a dough to it. Basically, it ages the dough. Mm-hmm. A sponge is another Nate term for it. Bigas, poulishes are different terms. Some Italian, French. Poulish means Polish. It actually is a technique that was developed by Polish bakers, a type of sponge that they took to the French. So the French called it, okay, we're going to use the Polish method. They called it the poulish. So there's, you know, when you trace it back, you find that nobody actually invented anything. Everybody got it from somebody else. But the bottom line is, all of these things are trainable once you understand it yourself, but you can't train your staff until you first understand it. And John, you went to school, to a school, one of many schools, and there's a few here in the States that are teaching techniques. How much did you learn that affected the way you made your pizzas, and what are some of the things, the takeaways that you got by going to a school?
A lot, but we're mostly on our own. We've just been pushing the limits. New York style pizzas, if you start out with a biga, it's probably the easiest thing to train. Just boom, boom, boom. We did some consulting for, and I had some old school Italian guy, and his New York pizza, he was putting condensed milk in there. And he could never answer why. I didn't know the difference. But the biga will get you a better crust. It'll get you a better bottom on it. because the caramelization occurs better with the biga, I think, than with the poulish. The poulish is, makes it a lighter, airy in on the inside. Am I right?
Well, I'm not sure how much of it's been quantified.
Okay.
But there are opinions that a wetter sponge like a poulish, which is 100% equal parts water and flour by weight, it's a sponge that also develops flavor, but that it can create less acidity in a shorter amount. You can get it to bubble up faster than a biga. A biga is basically a piece of old dough without any salt. So you make a piece of dough that's about the same thickness, same texture as a regular piece of dough, but it doesn't have salt in it, because that way you just put a small amount of yeast. The salt can affect and control yeast. Talk about function. And so by using no salt, you can get fermentation in a short amount of time, and you're creating an aged piece of dough that when you put it into your final dough, you have now aged your dough from just being, just off the mixer. It's going to have properties of a dough that maybe has already had 6 to 8 hours of fermentation. So it's another way to manipulate time by using a piece of old dough to control. That's why when they say, we just throw our old dough into the next batch, that's a type of a biga. It's a type of, a pre-fermented dough that is... But the problem is when each batch that has a different amount of old dough that goes in, you lose a little bit of control. And some people don't care about that because it still comes out good. But if you want to have more precision, then you have to figure out, you have a formula then that you use. So a biga is just one of many techniques. A poulish is a sponge. It's easier in some regards because you can mix it with a spoon. You don't need a mixer to do it. And you need a very tiny little bit of yeast because there's no salt in it, so there's no resistance, and it'll bubble up. Some people will put a tiny pinch of yeast in that, leave it out overnight, come back the next day when they mix their dough. If you're going back to the earlier question, if I need a dough on the same day, how can I get a good tasting dough on this, and with less fermentation? Chris Bianco doesn't overnight his doughs. He was out in Phoenix, Arizona. He didn't have any refrigeration. He made his doughs the morning of and used them that night. And nobody complained about his doughs, and he didn't require cold fermentation to get a killer dough because he used a small amount of yeast. But and it was a pretty wet dough, so it responded in quickly. It wasn't a stiff dough. So all these are factors, but the whole again, I want to go back to this concept of functionality. The function of a biga is not because so-and-so made it that way and showed me that biga seems to make a better piece. That's true, but there's got to be a reason why it makes a better dough. And the reason is the function of why it makes a better dough is that you're aging, you're quantum aging your dough so that you can get the properties in 6 to 12 hours that it might normally take you 24 to 36 hours to get. That's its rationale. And as far as training goes, I would suggest, number one, first, master it. One piece of advice I give to anybody who's getting into the baking game, whether it's pizza or bread, is consider joining the Bread Bakers Guild of America. It doesn't cost very much. Get a company membership if you can. Ask them to provide you some of their past quarterly issues. Every issue of their newsletter has tremendous technical information and recipes, for all sorts of things. But that organization, more than any other in the United States over the last 30 years, is responsible for the improvement of bread, and now I would say its impact on pizza, of any single group that I know of, because they brought the science and the techniques of the masters into the American mindset in a way that, went beyond what we had already come to on our own. And then from that, a lot of creative people took those ideas and said, okay, now I understand the functionality of all these techniques. Now what can I do with that? And how can I be creative the way that John and other pizza makers are creating products that didn't exist before? The way that a chef on MasterChef or Top Chef or what's the one, Iron Chef, and they give them a mystery basket of ingredients, and they can create something because they know the functions of those ingredients, and they can create something that was never seen before. And you don't necessarily have to do that in your business to create new things, but it gives you, if you're going to train your staff, then the best way to get them to understand it is you have to give them the why and not just the how. Mm-hmm. Here's the reason why we do this.
Yeah.
And so they always start with the why, and the how will take care of itself.
Yeah, New York style pizzas too. Cut a slice, show them what you have now, then show them what you have with a biga. You get less point drip It'll be a little crispier, especially if you're on the bricks. Are you guys on the screens or on bricks? Right on the bricks. Okay.
I hate to do this. We are at 10 o'clock. I have to go do another presentation. Liam, you and I need to go over to a different room. I'm going to be downstairs starting after this next presentation from about 12:30 on. I'll be somewhere near where the pizza competitions are being held. They're going to give me a table and a booth, and I'm going to be there doing podcasts throughout the rest of the day, and then and signing books. So if any of you are interested in this book, you know, come by. I'll sign them because I'm going to have to go over to the other room.
Come see my keynote tomorrow.
And then come see John.
11 o'clock. You'll see some really cool pizzas. And
what are you speaking on tomorrow?
You'll hate
John?
It if you hate food. Huh?
What are you going to say? What are you going to talk about in your keynote?
Just creativity in pizzas and breads.
Thanks again to Central Milling for sponsoring this episode of Pizza Quest. To learn more about Central Milling's retail and commercial lines of flour, please visit centralmilling.com. That's it for this episode. If you want to hear more of our coverage from the Northeast Pizza and Pasta and Baking Expo, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. Pizza Quest is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.